100 days on the place, yeah, man. It's a kick it, you know. That's right.
Yeah, me rolling and rock it to the beat, and me love the sound.
Oh, Chess, you can mess with the sound. Better grab your girl, your posse, and gather round.
Yeah, me rolling and bobbing and going like a mad man. Oh, the man got the studio for 19 or long, so me say.
Hey, 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 Digital Sister here. How's everybody? Welcome, and thanks to my new friends in Turkey. It's so exciting when I reach even a wider audience around the world. Thanks so much for tuning in. First of all, I would like to thank everyone because after I dropped my podcast last Tuesday, I was one of the one of the four most active podcasts. And that was very exciting to me because I've been podcasting now for a little over a year now. And it was really exciting to get to the point where I'm up on the homepage as one of the most active. And it was also, in the second category where it was being, updated. So I was really excited to see the podcast in that lead position. So keep tuning in and keep helping the podcast to grow. Well, I'd like to just start out first by remembering two very wonderful people. First of all, I'd like to just send my condolences to the family of author B.B. Moore Campbell, who just passed away Monday a little bit after midnight. I had the privilege of interviewing her on August 20th, 2005 for my internet radio program, Demystifying Nonprofits. And she was charming, she was funny, and she was very insightful because I interviewed her about her new book at the time, which was called 72 Hour Hold, which was really a kind of a cloak and dagger novel about a mother who was trying to seek treatment for her daughter who was diagnosed with bipolar condition. And it was just a really interesting, great book, and I had a really great interview with her. So anytime you have a free moment, you can check out the interview I did with her last year by going to www.globaltalkradio.com and clicking on my show, Demystifying Nonprofits. When you do that, that will bring up my show page so that you can scroll down and see all of the shows that I've done for nearly 2 years. And again, look for the date, August 20th, because that way you can hear the interview I did with B.B. Moore Campbell anytime that you would like. She was just very charming and really very wonderful. And again, I send my condolences to her family. I was really shocked when I heard that she passed away on Monday. The other person I'd like to take a moment to remember was Ed Bradley. I had the pleasure of meeting him a few years ago when he came to Cleveland to speak for, I believe it was United Way, but I'm not really sure, it was a luncheon. But he was so gracious, and he shared the story about how he became a journalist, and he also talked about how important the relationship that he had with his mom was, because she was the one that kind of shaped him and kind of made him see that he could have a different life from where he grew up. I believe he grew up in Philadelphia. I'm not sure, but I think it's Philadelphia. But she showed him that he could have another life. And he, as well as one of my other favorites, Charlene Hunter Gault, who they were actually longtime friends, were, I think, the epitome of black journalists back in the day. Because, see, when the civil rights issues erupted back in the 60s, all of the news agencies were lily white. And they realized that they didn't have any reporters or really anchors, people of color. So they were really scrambling, trying to find black journalists who could go down south and report about all of the things that were going on as the civil rights movement erupted and exploded onto the American scene. And so Ed Bradley and Charlene Hunter Gault were at a very pivotal point in U.S. history, and they were at a really interesting point for their careers because they were really the trailblazers for many of the journalists who came later. And so they filled a very interesting and unique gap. I mean, they had it made because they were the voice at that time. And so it's with great sadness that we see a bit of that chapter closing. Ed Hewitt, who was the creator of 60 Minutes, said, as people were memorializing him at his memorial service at Riverside Church last week, that finding an Ed Bradley or finding another Ed Bradley would be pretty much next to impossible. But you know what? I don't even think it's about finding. I think the point here is that we have to do more to groom other journalists of color to step in and fill these positions, because I don't know what will happen, but I doubt very seriously that they will replace Ed with another African-American journalist. I don't know who that might be. Could be Carol Simpson, but I believe she's at ABC. But in any event, it should be about that there was some training, that there was someone who could possibly, you know, step in once Ed retired, but unfortunately he passed away. And kind of really what that speaks about, I'm going to talk about this for a brief moment because I think it's important, is that when Charlene and Ed came on the scene and really cut their chops with stories with the civil rights movement back in the, you know, late in the 60s and 70s with the Vietnam War, etc., they were there because of that need for African-American journalists. That's what affirmative action is all about. It's about having diversity in the workplace, having diversity within that particular medium so that you get a balanced view of the news. And the sad part, and I think which is unfortunate, as these great journalists who are now, you know, moving into their mid-60s, moving into their 70s, and at some point will retire, because of how things are being dismantled around the country, we are moving back to the day when, and we're already here, basically, we're moving back to the day when you turn on the channel and get news and information from all the various media outlets, we're really back to seeing newscasters who are primarily white. And that, I think, is kind of sad because it doesn't give us, I think, a full balance. It doesn't give us a richness that a Charlene Hunter Gault or an Ed Bradley would provide. And so you see, it will be very difficult for Don Hewitt to find someone else, because I'm sure that there has been no one else that they were training. I'm sure that Ed Bradley was it. And so we just have to do a better job at making sure there's a bit more balance in the news. But I was delighted, and I'm sorry that I was even no longer living in New York City, because I belonged to Riverside Church when I lived in New York City. I would have loved to have been at his service. The fact that he had a New Orleans-style funeral procession with Wynton Marsalis leading the mourners with the white handkerchiefs down the aisle to send his spirit away in a great way. I mean, that must have been really something to be part of. And so he was the consummate professional. As I said, when he spoke at that luncheon, he was very charming, very approachable, and one of the gifts that they gave him was a leather bomber jacket, and he didn't just take the jacket and put it aside on the chair. He put it on, and he continued to talk to everyone at the luncheon and just really engaged us in great conversation. So he was a class act, which we probably will never see again, and I'm sad to say that, because I wish that there were other journalists of color who would have the opportunity that he had and Charlene Hunter Gault had to really be a powerful voice and a powerful force in the news media. So anyway, I just wanted to just provide my comments about him, because I think he was just a great journalist. He was someone that... he was like an old friend, you know, because he was at CBS for like 26 years, and really, he was around as long as Pope John Paul II was around. So for many of us, you know, John Paul II was maybe the only pope that we really remembered. And with Ed Bradley, he is probably the only journalist that we will also kind of grew up with, you know, and it's sad that that is the end of the era for him. So it will be interesting to see how 60 Minutes fills that void, if they will fill the void with another journalist of color, or are we going to see the same old thing as we always have seen. But anyway, B.B. Moore Campbell and Ed Bradley will be missed. Ooh, now let's talk about the slur that was heard around the world. That story with Michael Richards has taken on a life, I think, something that he didn't anticipate, and the fact that we're still talking about it, I find that interesting. But one of the, I think, and I don't even know if it's an unintended consequence, but one of the great fall-offs from this is that comedian Paul Mooney, who, you know, he's pretty racy. He used to write for Richard Pryor and Dave Chappelle. He's, you know, very well known on the comic circuit. He, you know, he's been around for quite a long time. But his acts usually were pretty sharp and pretty raunchy and pretty to the point. But he said, and he said he's known Michael Richards for over 20 years, and he's going to be looking at him a little differently now too. But in any event, he said, looking at that clip that's been shown on internet, YouTube, whatever, looking at that clip, it really cured him of using the N-word, because he saw how detrimental it was and the effect that it has, and just the mean-spiritedness of the whole tirade that Michael Richards did. So I think that's a good thing, because maybe it's going to allow many people, especially African Americans in the entertainment industry, to start thinking about the words that they say. Because I've talked about that on many occasions, on how in the media in particular, you know, we know what we're saying. When things come out that are inappropriate, we know it. We know exactly what we're saying. And so I think he's finally, as he said, you know, Michael Richards was his Dr. Phil. It cured him. It woke him up. And he has made the decision that he is no longer going to put the N-word in his comedy act. He's not going to utter it. And he's also not going to utter the B-word, you know, calling females by another name. He's not going to utter that either. So I think that's great. And I think it's a wonderful first step to stop that. Because, you know, and I have to say, we can't have it two ways, you know. It can't be okay for another person of color or someone who's in the hip-hop realm to call you the N-word, and you might call other associates the N-word, but then when somebody else of another culture calls you that, you're ready to kill them, you know. So we have to kind of mesh that. We can't have it two ways, and I think the best way to have it is just not to use it at all. And I think we have to find other ways to describe each other. There's just another way to do it, because that word has such hate and such virulence attached to it, that if a lot of people really knew the history of, you know, where that came from and why, I don't think you'd be using it. I don't think you'd be calling your associates by that name. So I'm just glad that Paul Mooney has stepped up to the plate and has made the decision that he's not going to do it anymore. And I'm hoping that some of the other folks in the entertainment world will do the same, because it does nothing but demean and make us look silly when we keep using it, but then we get upset when somebody else uses it. So, you know, let's stop trying to have it both ways. But in any event, I just think it's you know, this whole thing is a fascinating story, because it took so long for the majority media to really filter out the whole story and to really say all the words that he said. So, you know, racism is alive and well, and we have to deal with it and attack it when it rears its ugly head. And for him to say, Michael Rich, is that, you know, just came out of nowhere, he's got to look at where that came from. And that kind of talk and that kind of precise wording is something that's deep-seated. And that's what he has to address. You know, going on the talk show circuit is okay, but he's really got to look at himself and how he really feels and how he really views, you know, African Americans, in particular African American men. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. And the interesting thing about this is that he went on Jesse Jackson's syndicated radio talk show, you know, to apologize once again. And Jesse Jackson, who, you know, is the king of boycott, is telling his listeners to boycott and not purchase the latest version of the Seinfeld TV program. And I think, you know, I don't know if it's true, but I think when Jerry Seinfeld arranged for Michael Richards to come on Dave Letterman that Monday night to apologize, you know, I don't think it was just to help Michael. I think it was about him trying to make sure that people continue to buy his videotapes of his show, because, you know, he's making a ton of money from that. And so, again, he was worried about and thinking about the economic ramifications of the situation. So I don't think he was just doing it out of the goodness of his heart for Michael. I think it was a little bit self-serving for himself too. And, you know, I hope people do take another look and maybe think about how they spend their money and send a message that, you know, it's just not cool. And even if we can't change what's in your heart, we can certainly change how we do things by what money we spend and how we spend our money. So it'll be interesting to see if there's, you know, a great impact on whether or not people buy the Seinfeld video collection as much as they did in the past before this whole situation came up. Ooh, but anyway, let's get right into the dirt, which is really what I want to get into. Now, remember a couple weeks ago I talked about how hot the radio show that Michael Baisden was doing? Well, unfortunately, 2 weeks ago, he just did his last live show, because I didn't know it, but it's in the media now, in some circles, that he was trying to negotiate his contract with ABC Radio to extend his contract. So, you know, apparently, you know, he liked what he was doing and he wanted to stay, and he had an incredibly booming audience, and people were just tuning in, talking about the show, because it was hot. I mean, it was off the hook. But in any event, I guess the executives at ABC Radio made him an offer that wasn't quite to his liking, and he was every much, you know, the bad boy of radio in these negotiations, and I guess got a little loud, got a little heated, and basically he stormed out, saying he wouldn't accept the offer that was given by ABC Radio. And so he stormed out. And so, you know, he hasn't been back on the air for like 2 weeks. So in the meantime, we've had comedian Monique, who I just think is really hysterical. I think she's, you know, she just seems to be real down to earth and real nice. But she's been filling in and doing a really, really superb job with filling in for Michael Baisden. But apparently now she wanted even more money than Michael Baisden asked for. So, you know, she's going to have just a run of maybe another week or two, and then they're going to find somebody else who's much cheaper. Now, the point that I'm getting at is, unfortunately, here he was, Michael Baisden, you know, he had the media, he was syndicated, I'm sure he was making big bucks, and yet that wasn't enough, okay? And so now, you don't even have the form, you know, because of your greed. Because of your ego. You know, you don't even have the show. And so I wonder if they will, if he will, you know, pop up on some other network. But I don't think he would have the reach that he had with ABC Radio. But greed got the best of him, and now he doesn't even have a show. And then here is Monique. You know, I mean, she's doing movies. She's doing her comedy acts, you know. So she's making, you know, a good income and entertainment income, because they get paid very well. But yet she wanted even more than he wanted. And again, it's the greed. And she's been doing a really bang-up job, and people were getting to know her on a whole nother level and relating to her in a whole nother way. And now she's not going to be there because of the greed. So I'm thinking, oh, we got to look at that. Why not just get the form and work it? I mean, that's like with Dave Chappelle. They give you $50 million, you freak out, and you don't have that form anymore, you know, when it could have expanded and really just blown up into something much bigger. So I think, you know, people, we should be looking at this stuff. If you have the opportunity to get to that point, don't be greedy. You know, get there. Get yourself established. Have it grow. I mean, then, gradually, they're going to start giving you the kind of money you want. But you don't go in there demanding that after, you know, 4, 5, 6 months. You know, that's crazy. And so now, we don't have him on the air anymore. The show was hot, okay? Monique's going to be gone. So, again, I think we just got to check the greed and look at that. And then you have to look at kind of, I think, a little bit of the hypocrisy. Because, you know, he's been the bad boy on the radio, but also, apparently, he's like that in real life, you know, from the negotiation. So, you know, maybe this is a time for him to look at himself and to check himself and see, you know, if he can modify some of his views so he can get back on the radio and deliver a hot show that was out of this world. But anyway, I just thought that was like really, really interesting, because I was wondering what happened to him. You know, I was liking Monique, but I was like wanting to hear him. But that's what happened. Greed. Now let's talk about something very interesting with Marvin Gaye and Jimi Hendrix. Has just come out that Marvin Gaye's manuscripts, I mean, we're talking hand-scribbled lyrics on pieces of paper, his classics, Heard It Through the Grapevine, Mercy, Mercy Me, Let's Get It On, and some other arrangements are going to be up for auction. And apparently, the material was given by Marvin Gaye to a friend years ago when he had revived his career back in London and in Europe. And so it was like a gift to this person for their support of him, you know, getting back into the music scene a couple years ago before he actually came back to the States. And so these manuscripts are going to be put up for sale in 4 blue leather portfolios, and they contain nearly all of Marvin Gaye's music, major music arrangements. I mean, gosh, I wish I had a few million dollars laying around that I could get that, because I think that would just be a wonderful piece of artifact to have, you know, in your collection. So I kind of wonder too, does his family know this is out there? Are they trying to get it? Or is it something that they're just going to let go? But within this auction is also going to be Jimi Hendrix Fender, I hope I can say it right, Stratocaster guitar that was from the 1960s. So you know that's a serious collector's item. But anyway, it's kind of sad that, you know, Marvin Gaye's music will be up for auction. So I hope maybe, you know, some great music collector, or Quincy Jones, or just maybe one of the rappers or whatever who has some money, will, you know, will get it and collect it and keep it in safekeeping, or at least donate it to one of the you know, rock museums, the one in Cleveland and the one out in Seattle. But that's mostly rock. I don't know if they would include, you know, R&B and soul. But in any event, I hope it doesn't, you know, get lost, because what a find that is to have the manuscripts from Marvin Gaye. Ooh, I would love to have it anytime. But let me just move to a little bit more of a let me stay with the dirt. Let me stay with the dirt before I get to the other thing here. Check this out. Now, Nas's, yes, the rapper Nas, his ex-girlfriend, her name is Carmen Bryan, and she is the mother of his daughter Destiny, has written this tell-all book, and it accuses him of being, you know, a bit of a batterer, a cheater, and somebody who wasn't paying child support. But her book is called It's No Secret, and she claims that she was also asked by Nas to participate in a threesome with singer Kelis, however you want to say it, who has since become his wife. They got married, I think, last year or maybe 2 years ago. And she also admits that she, like, screwed around with Jay-Z, Allen Iverson, while she was dating Nas. And then when Nas got wind of this, he apparently beat her, she puts, you know, in quotes, with a closed fist after finding out about this. And then apparently when she found out about his cheating, she would just get the pepper spray out and spray him down like he was, you know, a dog whenever he cheated. So I can't imagine, you know, what that relationship was like. You know, she's getting knocked around, he's getting pepper sprayed. In any event, but she's got this book coming out, and it's probably going to be very juicy, like the Video Vixen type of thing, just to learn a little bit more about some of the people that are out there. Now, she didn't just stop at Nas with her gossip. She also says that Kelis doesn't wear deodorant, which I thought was kind of funny. She said Jay-Z scrubs his behind in the shower. And Nas once turned down a date with Beyonce because he said, to be honest, I can't take her breath. So, you know, I don't know if this is true, but I think it's going to be quite a dishy book, a gossip book on some of the more current hip-hop figures. Because, you know, we hear a lot about some of these celebs in Hollywood, but we don't always hear about the dirt with the rappers. So her book may be the icing on the cake that really gives us more insight about some of the personalities, about some of the people that we like, and with the music that we like, you know? So let me just shift gears for a moment and talk about, you know, the shooting in New York City, because I just think it's horrible. And I'm really glad that Mayor Bloomberg came out and said that the shooting was unacceptable and inexplicable. So I'm glad that he came out and said that, because, you know, so often when these kinds of things happen, especially when they happen in New York City, because I used to live there, and, you know, I was there when they shot Eleanor Bumper. She was the old grandmother up in the Bronx, something like that, and been a couple other things that have happened. But I'm glad that he has said that, and that there will be an investigation to find out why, you know, 50 rounds were fired on this young man when he was at a bachelor party, only that he was going to be married a few hours later to the mother of his two kids. And, you know, I'm listening to the news and they're trying to justify and all that, but the fact of the matter is this young man is dead. He was killed on what was to be his wedding day. His two kids will no longer have a father. They keep trying to justify it and justify it, but all I see is every time these shootings happen, it's usually a black man that ends up dead, okay? That's the thing we have to look at, and that's the thing that people don't always want to look at. If it was a shooting that happened to a Hasidic Jew in Crown Heights, it would be mass riot, okay? So I think we have to look at the issue. And the issue is why, when these things happen, that usually the person who ends up dead is an African-American male. Excuse me, I had to cough there, got a little dry. We got to look at that and really address that and stop dancing around that issue. But at least the mayor has come out and said, you know, something's not right, and I'm glad that they're going to at least check it out. Now, let's talk about a little bit with the nonprofit situation. I didn't even know that this could happen, but just so you know, apparently The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has fined the American Red Cross facility. Now, this is in West Henrietta, New York. They fined them a record $5.7 million for violating blood safety laws. And there was something else, terms of a consent decree, which talks about the lack of quality assurance, inventory management, control of non-conforming blood products, donor screening, blood component manufacturing, that apparently there were some problems. So the FDA has fined this particular facility. I mean, I didn't know that the FDA had that power to do that, but I guess there has to be an organization that oversees the Red Cross with their blood products and manufacturing of blood products. So I just thought that was a very interesting bit of information that was in the news. And see, very often when you hear about information about the nonprofits, it's really pretty much two organizations. You hear a lot about the Red Cross because it's so large and they're involved in so many rescue and assistance missions. And the other one is, you know, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Those are the two, I think, major foundations that are very often in the news regularly. And that's why I like to talk about situations with nonprofits and have my radio show about that, because, you know, there are a lot of other nonprofits who are doing interesting things too, but generally just those large ones will capture the attention of the media. So I just thought that's very interesting to learn about that, hey, I guess there is some way to oversee what the Red Cross is or is not doing. Ooh, let me see what else is going on here. Well, I think that's probably it for now. I think that's enough. I've probably talked to you enough. But in any event, one more thing. Now, remember last week I talked about the original superstars of jazz fusion? Well, I wrote an article that's going to be in a freelance entertainment guide here in Cleveland talking about, you know, my experience of just watching the show backstage, you know, after sneaking in backstage. And so I thought that was very cool and very exciting. So once that comes out, I'll probably be able to tell you a little bit more next week, and maybe I'll have some reactions that I can share with you about it. But as I wrote with the article, it was one moment, it was one night that time stood still. Even though it was 2006, it felt like 1974, because that's when the original superstars, they were hot. They were all about jazz. That's what we were listening to. We love them. We love them. And so what I said in the article, again, is that just for that moment, you know, time stood still, and you remembered, you know, where you were when you heard some of the songs from them, from Roy Ayers, Bobby Humphreys, or Lonnie Liston Smith. So that's what I kind of touched on in the article. But I'll keep you abreast of what happens, and I'll let you know of any of the great reactions that I have. But I just thought it was a night to remember, and I was just really glad that I was able to share that experience with readers. So I'll be able to fill you in a little bit more next week. Well, I think that's it for now. This is really it. Thanks so much for tuning into the podcast. Thank you so much for making me one of the four most active. That was a dream come true. So take care, and I will be back to you in a few days. Digital Sister signing out. You can't mess with this song.